This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of April, and this week the president claimed to have total authority to order the reopening of the economy from the coronavirus closures. But he doesn't have that total authority. While the federal government has certain powers to restrict interstate commerce, the orders requiring the cessation of much economic and social activity have necessarily come down from state and local governments. They're the governments that would have to reverse them. So the president changed his tune, saying he is authorizing state governors to make their own reopening decisions on their own timelines, notwithstanding that such authorization already comes from the Constitution. Late in the week, the White House issued guidelines about how those states should move to reopen the economy, and the guidelines were vague enough to draw relatively limited objections. But they have not put forward a plan for testing that looks sufficiently robust to help the economy stay open. To discuss all of this, I want to bring in my left, right, and center panel. On the left, Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Rich, this approach where the president is basically saying, you know, here, it's yours, governors, you figure this out, I'm authorizing you to do that, and here are my big councils of people who are going to advise me on this. Is this the president basically trying to be able to say, I did my part, if you're not back at work on May 1st, go blame your governor?
Well, I think, one, he wanted to be the first to have a big reopening announcement, because there are some governors, red state governors, that were probably going to do it very soon regardless. Two, there's utility in having these federal guidelines out there that, are, as far as I can tell, are completely sensible. But this week, with the total authority claim, I mean, it's just totally ridiculous. He must have been freelancing on that. I can't imagine anyone around him. No one who had attended one law school, constitutional law class, would have counseled him that he, at any sense, had total authority, or really any authority, to order the governors to open up in this instance. And it was inevitable that he would have to back down from that, and he did really quickly.
Christine, what did you make of this chain of events this week?
Yeah, I would have to agree with Rich here. I think that Trump wants to be seen as doing anything positive and distance himself from anything negative. Openings are seen as good, so he wanted to involve himself in the opening by producing these guidelines. And then, yes, should those openings go wrong, be able to wash his hands, say, I gave you the guidelines, this is your fault, and distance himself from the problems. You know, his, I don't take any responsibility for this, but then the buck stops with me for opening and closing, is really just, you know, a farce. It's designed to get him as close to the positive action, but also give him an out when, you know, outbreaks recur or things go wrong.
A thing I've found kind of strange about this whole dialogue is that really neither the president nor governors can actually reopen the economy themselves. Only the public can reopen the economy. And the public did a lot to close the economy down in places before the government had explicitly told them to do so. I mean, if you look at data from OpenTable, they show that restaurant traffic was already down more than 70% at the point where each state decided to close the restaurants by order. And so, you know, a governor can lift one of these orders. The president can urge governors to lift these orders, but he can't make people shop. In most cases, he can't make people go to work. And so I feel like an ingredient that has been left out of this is some of the measures that would make the public feel confident that once they are allowed to go out and do things, that it is safe to do so. It feels like that's a missing ingredient here.
Absolutely. This is one of the irritations I have with some of my friends on the right who are really harsh about these shutdowns. They were largely driven by the public. And even if there hadn't been official orders, maybe it wouldn't some parts of the country wouldn't be as shut down as they are now, but a lot of it would. But the other side of the coin is if these shutdowns seem arbitrary or excessive. We've seen some of this in Michigan with Governor Whitmer having these really intricate rules about what you can buy from, you know, a Home Depot or not, or if they just don't seem useful anymore, people aren't going to abide by them, or at least there's going to be a major push against them. And I do think it makes sense for parts of the country now to begin to open up again cautiously. I have a friend who lives in a town outside of Jacksonville, Florida. He's been in his house for a month. There's been one case in the town where he lives, a former Jacksonville Jaguar football player who got it playing golf from someone that probably doesn't have to stay in his house much longer. But to achieve a reopening that does anything like get our economy back to normal, that's quite far away and requires a regime, robust regime of testing and contact tracing that I'm increasingly skeptical we'll actually be able to do. So I think probably what will happen here is the summer will have to bail us out, and hopefully the heat and humidity, which we can't be sure about this, but seem likely to knock the virus down. And then hopefully by the fall, you have treatments that make it less virulent.
Right. I also agree with you, Josh. I think this has been the ongoing and perhaps most visible issue with the administration's handling of this entire crisis. President Trump, as we all know, full of bluster. He loves to talk about what we should be doing, what he envisions happening, what, you know, surprise miracles will come sometime in the future that he won't specify. But look, there are clear things that we would need if we actually want to reopen the economy, get people back in public in a safe way. We need testing, a lot of testing, enough testing so that people feel comfortable going places because they know that the people in those places are not infected. From day one, we haven't had enough tests, even though the president seemingly once a week says that there will be tests everywhere, that it's totally possible to get a test whenever you want, that you can drive up to a Walmart and get a test. None of this has happened, and none of it is going to happen in the near future, it seems. We need the ability to trace people who are sick with the coronavirus so that they are not spreading it to the public at large. And we need hospital capacity so that people know that if they do get sick, they'll be able to go to a hospital and be treated by a physician, that there will be ventilators and the medicine that they need so that they aren't petrified, too petrified to go shopping. Because as you were saying, we saw the first big dips in the economy before these stay-at-home orders happened, right? You know, people, even if their governors say that they can move around, no one's going to go to a restaurant if they're afraid that when they go to the restaurant, they're going to catch a virus and die. You know, if you can catch coronavirus while golfing, which is kind of the most socially distanced sport seemingly possible, you know, people will not feel safe going back. And those who do go back will be those who are desperate for employment and money, which is extremely understandable. But yes, this will keep the virus going in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, Rich, you said you think the White House reopening plan looked pretty reasonable. Isn't the big missing piece what Christine references there, the plan to get testing up to a level where it's sustainable to do some of the reopening things the White House would like to do?
Yeah, I said the guidelines are reasonable, and I think they are kind of the three phases and the gating system and what you would look at to know whether you can go from phase one to phase two to phase three. All that's reasonable, but the testing regime is the big missing part, and how we actually are going to implement that. And one thing that's been a little disturbing, last couple weeks after going way up, testing has stalled. Has to do with some administrative inefficiencies, some problems with the supply chain, including, credibly enough, a lack of swabs in some places. And then also, as cases go down, and if we're only testing people who are basically presenting with symptoms and feel sick, you're also going to see testing plateau or decline. So what you need is some system to test people who aren't sick or don't know they're sick yet to monitor for breakouts before they run out of control. And that's going to require a lot of thought. It's going to require a lot of players, including, you know, big corporations, employers probably, testing. And none of that has been thought through yet.
Christine, Rich mentioned some discontent about some of the aspects of these state orders that are intended to restrict non-essential activity in Michigan, where there's been a fair amount of protest. I think there's been a lot of attention because Governor Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan is considered a likely vice presidential candidate. But this Michigan order was really granular in certain ways compared to a lot of other states' orders. And you had, you know, stores could stay open, but there were categories of merchandise that they couldn't sell. And so that felt kind of arbitrary to some people. people, and I think some businesses had difficulty implementing those in the right way. Like, stores are not supposed to sell furniture, and then people were sharing a picture from a Walmart that was not selling car seats. And so I think people quite reasonably said, you know, a car seat is essential if I have a child who needs to be put in that. That's not really furniture. It's an automotive good. But when the government gets so specific, I sort of worry about the ability to implement that in a way where people don't feel like this is becoming an unreasonable imposition on my daily life, on activities that are truly essential, and whether that ends up wearing on the public's willingness to comply with these orders in the long run. How do you balance sort of, you know, trying to really keep people home when you can without micromanaging too much of what they do when they're out?
Right. So I think you're right in pointing out that Gretchen Whitmer in particular has been a site of protest, someone to rail against in many ways, specifically because Donald Trump has picked her out and pointed her out as a foe, as, you know, something of a punching bag, as one name, one figure, that woman, to sort of blame the failures of this regime on. But I do think that you're right, that this specificity can be jarring and annoying to everyday people if they don't understand why these regulations are coming, what exactly they mean. If I can hazard a guess, I would imagine that some of the specificity in those regulations has to do with, you know, which objects, which sales might involve, you know, more people touching certain things and passing that touch on to others. But unless that's explained in a really clear way to the public and the risks are made really clear, it's hard for people to stomach. And I think that governments and the administration at large have to do a better job at really explaining to people what exactly social distancing is for, what exactly these regulations are meant to prevent. The White House, in fact, could be doing a much better job explaining that social distancing is not, in fact, a liberal Bolshevik plot of some kind. It's actually, you know, a healthy precaution that people need to take.
Rich, what do you make of the, you know, the president has sort of gone back and forth in terms of his commitment to this, but on balance, the president, you know, I mean, he keeps extending the recommendations basically encourage the states to do these stay-at-home orders. He has mostly indicated that people should be taking these steps, and yet there seems to be a lot of resistance to these orders, at least in certain parts of the right. And when you look at photos of these protests that you're seeing in state capitals, you're seeing people with a lot of Trump paraphernalia. Why has the president's more or less endorsement of these measures to stop the spread of the virus, why hasn't that spread all the way through the conservative movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. With Trump, he's obviously of two minds, as he is on a lot of things. But I think he realizes, or has to this point, what the cost would be of opening up too soon and how necessary these measures were. But then, you know, he has business leaders and political advisors in his ear constantly, you know, saying you're destroying the economy, which is true. I mean, there is enormous cost to these shutdowns. We should want to open up as soon as plausible and as soon as we're not going to create another huge problem for ourselves. But it's been interesting. There are figures on the populist right who have snapped totally back to kind of a Tea Party libertarian rhetoric or attitude. There are exceptions. You know, Tucker Carlson is one who's supported taking this virus seriously from the beginning and serious measures to squelch it. Tom Cotton, Arkansas, another. But there are others that have refound their own libertarianism, which is why I've wondered, as we talked about, you know, the contours of the right and the future of the right, just how long lasting some of this populism will be. And for some folks, it just turns out, you know, having a Democratic governor tell you what you can or can't buy at Home Depot is enough to reactivate all the kind of free market libertarian instincts that were supposed to be left behind.
You know, I do think that we are seeing the results and the lasting results of President Trump and Fox News's positioning earlier in this epidemic, when they were calling it a hoax, when there was a sort of nod and wink by the president that, you know, this coronavirus is really not a big deal and we shouldn't be taking it seriously. And I'm not going to wear a mask just because Dr. Fauci tells me to. Trump's fans take him seriously. And there's enough conspiratorial thinking that has grown and flourished on the right that any indication from the president that they could be of another mind is seen as an invitation to become a culture warrior, to make this a political movement, a fight against the left, even against all common sense. Common sense and an ability to actually sort of listen to the science and do what's best for the community at large is something that President Trump has damaged, and we're continuing to see what that looks like.
I think that's true, although I think certain public health authorities didn't do themselves any favors with the early messaging specifically discouraging people from obtaining masks. I mean, you had the Surgeon General tweeting out that people should stop trying to buy masks, that they're not effective when used by the general public. And I realized that there were legitimate concerns about PPE for hospitals and we needed to ensure the availability. But that's one area where I think there's been a whiplash in terms of the public health advice. And, you know, I think that in general, public health advice has been good and people should be listening to these authorities. But I think when you have that sort of turnaround, it cuts into the, you know, public trust in the nature of those measures. Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Christine Emba of The Washington Post to talk about the World Health Organization. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. One of the announcements the president made this week is that he is withdrawing U.S. funding for the World Health Organization. The WHO provides expertise and guidance as countries around the world fight epidemic diseases like COVID-19, but it has come under criticism, not just by conservatives, for the way it has handled this pandemic. In particular, the WHO is viewed as having been too solicitous of the concerns of the Chinese government, praising the Chinese response even though the Chinese government took early steps to suppress news of the novel virus that may have fostered its spread. The WHO also generally excludes Taiwan from participation, in line with China's view that Taiwan is a renegade province, even though Taiwan has had one of the world's most successful COVID prevention programs. As described by PBS NewsHour, the Trump administration is withholding the funds in hopes of pressuring the WHO on three points. They want an enforcement mechanism so member countries have to share information about disease outbreaks, and they want the WHO to narrow its focus to infectious disease, away from other issues like highway accidents. We're joined now by Daniel Dresner. Dan is a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Josh.
So first of all, can he do this? Isn't this money for the WHO appropriated by Congress? Why can the president just withhold it?
Well, in some ways, this is almost a replay of what we've seen with Ukraine, right? Which was another instance in which Congress had already authorized the aid, and the president presumably can delay it, but can't necessarily completely stop it, or would run afoul of, I believe, the Impoundments Act in doing so. But I'm pretty sure that Trump will be able to somehow declare a sort of emergency justification for at least delaying or reviewing, which is, I believe, what the as you said, what the argument the administration is making so far.
What will be the practical effect of withholding these funds from the WHO?
Well, there are two practical effects. The first is that it obviously weakens the WHO. The U.S. is the largest contributor, contributes a little more than, I think, 20% of the WHO's budget. And so obviously withholding these funds potentially weakens their ability to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. On the other hand, it's also worth remembering that I believe the U.S. is already behind in terms of its payments to the WHO. The second effect is that if this persists, it basically guarantees that China will actually exercise even more influence over the World Health Organization. And indeed, this is in some ways a small example of a larger pattern that the Trump administration is pursued towards a variety of the United Nations organizations, which is the Trump administration, when it came to office, was profoundly skeptical of multilateralism in general and the UN specifically, and generally has tried to reduce browbeat the UN into positions that it favors. As a result of this, the U.S. has pulled out of different U.N. agencies or cut its contributions to others, which has opened up a significant window for China to step in and exercise a leadership role. So it is telling, for example, that the U.N. has 15 different sort of standalone agencies. There is now a Chinese national running four of them. And indeed, the U.S. was just able to stave off China from running the World Intellectual Property Organization. if the U.S. withdraws from the WHO or withdraws significant funding from the WHO, the World Health Organization is simply going to turn to China as its potential bank, and as a result, will wind up being even more subservient to Beijing.
Rich, what do you make of that? I mean, I think a lot of people, their first reaction, they look at this and they're like, you know, you're going to withdraw funding from the WHO in the middle of a pandemic. That seems crazy. And then Dan lays out there reasons why this could actually strengthen China's hand. If the source of our concerns here is that China has too much influence, isn't this the wrong move to make?
You know, one, the WHO is not going to grind to a halt. It's not even clear exactly when this funding, withholding of funding would have any effect at the WHO. Two, I think the WHO in particular has just been handled this appallingly. And, you know, one reason Taiwan got the coronavirus so right, it didn't believe the thing China or the WHO said about this. The WHO chose to believe China rather than Taiwan early on, which made it a huge difference. So I think this withholding of funds is a way to enforce some accountability and transparency about what happened, and perhaps to create pressure for these reforms the administration is looking for or changes. But it's really hard to change the course of these multilateral UN agencies, which have a momentum of their own that's just very hard to change. So I support the effort. I'm a little skeptical of how much is going to come of it.
It's interesting that Rich says that, you know, Taiwan succeeded by ignoring both the WHO and China's information. One would have wished that the U.S. did the same. But in fact, on January 24th, so like a month after the virus was discovered in China, Donald Trump himself tweeted, "China has been working very hard to contain the coronavirus. The United States greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency." This is exactly the thing that he is criticizing the WHO for doing. This is another excuse to scapegoat, a way for Donald Trump to deflect responsibility to the WHO and keep people from noticing that, in fact, he too believed China. And he too downplayed the virus for, in fact, much longer than that organization did. I am, I have to say, one of those people who would say that, yes, it is rather crazy to remove funding from a World Health Organization during a pandemic. It's true that, you know, this defunding would probably not actually physically take place until about 3 months from now when the next tranche of funding is due. And the U.S. is constantly and has always been in arrears in its funding of international organizations. But the WHO is one of the organizations that will be working to help contain the pandemic in the developing world, especially. And that is necessary. The U.S. isn't going to pay for that. China may pay for that. And as a result, China, as Dan says, will have even more influence in Africa, in Asia, in all of the countries that the United States should be trying to take a stand in. If we want to make this world less of a Chinese-controlled world, then we shouldn't be ceding control to China.
Dan, setting aside the merits of this particular tactic of trying to withhold funding from the WHO, what do you make of the criticisms of them during this crisis? Are they, in fact, too influenced by China? Do we have some good points about how the WHO should be operating differently?
I think there are some valid points made. There's valid criticisms of the WHO here. But it's worth stressing, no one, you know, not the WHO, not China, not the United States, has handled this terribly well. So this isn't unique to the WHO or China. China's been much less than transparent in terms of the origins of the virus. They were reluctant to let WHO officials come in. Despite all of this, as you say, the WHO has been, you know, slavish in its devotion to China, has not criticized it. Indeed, there was that very embarrassing viral video of a WHO official refusing to acknowledge even the existence of Taiwan, and that's problematic. That said, it's also worth pointing out that the WHO has not criticized the United States either in terms of how it has handled the pandemic, and you can make many, many criticisms of how the United States has handled it. And even given the imperfect performance of both the WHO and China, the U.S. did get relatively early warning that this was, A, a going to be a problem. You know, think about the call from the Chinese head of the Chinese CDC to Robert Redfield, the head of the U.S. CDC, as well as the WHO itself, which did issue a public health emergency of international concern in the last week of January, and furthermore issued tests that actually worked in January, in contrast to what the CDC did came up with. So, you know, it's safe to say that no one has handled this well. But if you're going to make the perfect the enemy of the good, then you wind up in a position where, you know, you're trying to browbeat an agency right in the middle of a pandemic, and as a result is not necessarily going to advance the cause of public health that much. You know, as someone who just wrote a book comparing the president to a toddler, this reads much more like a tantrum than an actual exercise of well-thought-out policy.
I think it's one thing to say no one handled it well, which is true. It's another to compare China's failures to anyone else's. China was jailing and disappearing journalists who were blowing the whistle on this, punishing doctors, creating an atmosphere of fear in the entire medical community, which knew what was going on. And if it had handled this somewhat transparently and responsibly at the beginning, could have squelched it, could have genuinely contained it in Wuhan and not let it become a global pandemic that's literally changed the course of human history, that's created enormous suffering and death around the world and economic calamities. That's all on China. And the WHO swallowed every one of their lies at the beginning and has not said one discouraging word since then about how China handled this. But it has, the head of the WHO has criticized Taiwan, which had it right, because Taiwan allegedly was a source of racist attacks on him. This is an organization that has shamefully betrayed its mission, and there's just no way around it.
You know, I would say one response I would have is that in some ways the WHO is like many other UN agencies, which is, by the way, the source of conservative frustration from Rich and others, and much of it justified, which is because it is a multilateral institution that relies on the states that fund it and help staff it, it inevitably winds up, you know, being extremely reluctant to criticize its members, particularly members who bankroll it to a considerable degree. And China does fund the World Health Organization, not as much as the United States, but is a significant funder of it. So if this was a different kind of emergency and we were looking at a different UN agency, we would be probably making the same kind of criticisms. I would also say that not to defend China, but I suppose the Chinese response to this would be that they have taken, you know, draconian measures first to censor the outbreak, but then also to prevent internal movement within China and restricting Hubei province. And their argument would probably be that in and of itself also alleviated an even worse spread of the coronavirus pandemic. But otherwise, I mean, Rich's comments are well taken.
Yeah, part of this discussion that has bothered me the whole way through is people sort of acting like the blame has to go in one place or another. I mean, I think it is clearly true that China made some very serious missteps and did some malevolent things, especially early on in the outbreak, and that they also did a number of things that were quite effective in stopping the outbreak. And even though I don't necessarily trust the Chinese data in its particulars, we know that there aren't enormous number of bodies piling up in Shanghai. We know that they have gotten the outbreak under control and that has had some positive effects around the world, even as their late action had very negative effects. And similarly, I feel like in terms of domestic U.S. politics, there's a reluctance on the left to talk about culpability from China or the WHO or other external actors because it feels like it is letting President Trump off the hook when two things can be true at the same time, that China allowed this to get out of control in a way that had seriously negative effects for the world, and that the U.S. did not react quickly enough to that problem or to the way that that problem was coming onto our shores or the way that it was spreading within the United States. I don't think that, you know, that saying that China was a bad actor here means that, you know, that stuff isn't President Trump's fault. There is a lot of blame to go around for this. And I think there should sort of be room for the idea that, you know, that lots of people screwed up and lots of people need to be held accountable here. Dan, I want to ask about, you know, when if we lay out these concerns that you have there about the way these international organizations are influenced by their funders and that China is an increasingly important funder, what do we do about any of that? Because this feels like part of a broad set of Chinese problems, not just to do with these international organizations. You also have U.S. firms, things like, you know, Marriott, the NBA, that basically have to go grovel before the Chinese government for permission to do business in China. They have to toe the Chinese Communist Party line on issues like Taiwan and Hong Kong and the treatment of Muslims in China in order to get that permission to do business. And China has been somewhat effective in suppressing criticism of its actions in this way. What can we do about any of that from the United States perspective? Because, you know, it seems like, you know, the president has an impulse where he's upset about these sorts of things, but his policies don't seem to have done anything about that.
That's correct. I think there are two things. The first is what you can do at the sort of multilateral level within the UN system, and then what do you do with U.S. corporations that want to access the Chinese market. On the UN side of things, you have to choose one of two things to do, or potentially both. The first is that you don't withdraw from the system, because if you withdraw from the system or you pull the U.S. back, all that does is give China, you know, even more influence within these organizations. And these organizations are not going to go away. They represent focal points. It's extremely hard to create a new agency, some sort of substitute for the World Health Organization. And it's particularly hard to do it in the middle of a pandemic. So, you could try, you know, if you're really ambitious, to develop that kind of substitute, a sort of long-term plan of creating essentially the sort of NATO to the UN, a more Western-based organization that would presumably evince, you know, more liberal democratic values. But that is a decade-long project that actually requires cooperation from allies, and it's not like the Trump administration has necessarily been good at doing that either. With respect to U.S. firms in accessing the Chinese market, there, I do think the U.S. has a little more, or the U.S. government has a little more leeway and leverage, because while it is true that these firms obviously want to access the Chinese market, the U.S. market also matters a great deal. And so, you know, if you have, statements, not necessarily action, but, you know, statements from the bully pulpit, you know, naming and shaming corporations that are essentially kowtowing to Beijing, you know, that in and of itself can generate consumer reactions that would cause these corporations to change their tune. And indeed, you did see that to some extent after the NBA incident, when the general manager of the Houston Rockets, you know, posted a tweet about the Hong Kong protests. Originally, the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, you know, scolded Daryl Morey, general manager of the Houston Rockets, for doing so. And then there were others like LeBron James who said the same thing. And then there was in the U.S. a public backlash to that, and that caused Silver to back down relatively quickly. So the U.S. market still matters a fair amount. And that's where I do think steps can be taken to make sure that U.S. firms recognize that while, you know, they don't necessarily want to needlessly alienate Beijing, you presumably don't want to needlessly alienate American consumers as well.
Christine, what is the left's perspective on a strategy to contain Chinese influence? Is that an important goal? And if so, how should it be pursued? Because, I mean, Dan talks about the importance of maintaining our influence through these international organizations. But a platform point that was shared between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the last election, also shared by Donald Trump, was that we shouldn't join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that would have been one of those international organizations that would have helped counter Chinese influence in the area of trade. So what is the strategy if it's not pulling out from the WHO? How do you engage in a way that contains China?
Right. I think that my main objection, and many reasonable people's main objection, to the idea of pulling out from the WHO as a way to stick it to China is that, you know, this is just not the time. While there are many, many quibbles and qualms that one might have with the WHO and indeed with the structure of multilateral institutions more generally, during a global pandemic is maybe not the time to withdraw funding, to leave the organizations, to stand back and let someone else take over. You know, I wish that, and I think others on the left would agree, that the Trump administration, that American administrations more generally, would put some of this energy that they're expending on hating on the WHO towards, you know, building a testing regime that works in our own country. on a larger scale, perhaps a political platform scale, instead of just, you know, shouting at China and talking about how China is bad, I wish that some of this energy could be put to, you know, moving production and manufacturing and business capabilities back to the U.S. When they've been offshored to China, to holding corporations accountable to, yes, naming and shaming leaders who would rather base their businesses abroad than in the United States and support United States workers with a living wage. I think that there's a lot to be said for bringing that production, for bringing that energy back to the United States. I just don't think that during a global pandemic is the moment to be making these unnecessary moves.
Rich, has the administration been tough on China where it counted? I mean, I'm really struck by this reporting about how the Trump administration was processing information about this outbreak in China and in January and February, and the president's reluctance to criticize the Chinese government because he thought it would jeopardize the trade deal he was trying to make. And the trade deal is pretty superficial. You know, the president had basically decided that selling more soybeans to China was the number one strategic interest in the China relationship, which strikes me as both stupid and also a position that's going to be really ineffective for trying to pressure China where we really need to.
Yep. Even now, he blows hot and cold on China and often cites that deal, which is, as you say, is a very superficial deal. I do think there'll be a sustained effort now, as Christine mentioned, to see if we can pull back parts of our supply chain from China. And this episode has demonstrated how being dependent on China for key medical supplies and medicines during crisis like this is not a good idea. Even if China weren't a malevolent power, which it is, we've just seen even allies want to hold on to their stuff and take care of their people first. So that's I think there'll be a serious and it'll end up being a bipartisan effort to find some way to do that. I also think China will be one of the divisions in the presidential campaign because Joe Biden very often sounds Pollyannish about China and seems to have an attitude, you know, caught in amber from about 15 or 20 years ago when we're still all very optimistic about what the trajectory of China would be.
Dan, what do you make of that? What do you think should be the strategy going forward?
There's no denying that I think this is going to cause a rethink within the United States. And you'd sort of seen that already even before the coronavirus pandemic had broken out. The degree to which the number of Democrats that had sort of embraced, frankly, the trade war on China represented what you might consider a new consensus. And I do think there are issues surrounding what my colleagues Henry Farrell and Abe Newman call weaponized interdependence. The question of whether or not China, if it's in the center of key global supply chains, can use those to exercise leverage. And there's a suggestion that, in fact, they already did so with respect to the United States, that there was essentially an entente between the Trump administration and Chinese authorities in which the Chinese authorities agreed to continue shipping medical equipment to the United States in return for President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo to stop referring to the coronavirus as the Chinese coronavirus or the Wuhan coronavirus. That said, I also do think you want to be careful about exaggerating the degree to which the U.S. is ostensibly dependent on China for sort of key medical equipment. I think there's a Congressional Research Service report that suggests that something like less than 10% of what the U.S. imports in terms of medical equipment and so on and so forth comes from China. So it's very easy to sort of paint China as the boogeyman here. And I do think that there's going to be a need to be a rethink in terms of which parts of our economic relationship need to be managed with an eye towards greater resiliency and greater diversification of supply. But that said, you also don't want to overgeneralize that, because if you do that, then what you're doing is cutting the U.S. Out of more efficient networks.
Dan Dresner of the Fletcher School at Tufts and the Brookings Institution. Dan also has a new book out. It's called The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with economist Jason Furman. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. The CARES Act, which was the third phase of federal legislation intended to provide relief from the coronavirus outbreak, has lots of individual parts. $1,200 checks to individual American adults are the most high-profile provision, but they only make up about $300 billion of the $2.2 trillion of aid in the bill. A similar amount is expected to go toward heavily enhanced unemployment benefits, adding $600 a week to unemployment checks and making unemployment available to the self-employed and to people who had to quit their jobs because of the crisis. And there's a $350 billion program to help small businesses meet payroll. They can borrow money at very low interest, and then the government forgives the loans so long as those businesses keep paying their employees. But there's a problem. This last program has run out of money. In less than 2 weeks, the Small Business Administration allocated all the money to applicants, and now members of Congress are arguing about what to do. Republicans want an immediate cash infusion to the program. Democrats agree with that in principle, but they want to add other spending simultaneously, particularly to support state and local governments, and Republicans have resisted that. So for now, there's a stalemate, exacerbated by the fact that Congress is out of town and not expected back until early May. This leaves small businesses waiting. To discuss what to do about that, Jason Furman joins us now. Jason is an economist and professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
So is it a sign of success that these funds got allocated so fast? It was, you know, less than 2 weeks from when the program opened.
I am not positive I love the premise of the program. Once you've legislated a program, you should deliver on it well. And I think there were some initial bumps in the road, but overall, I think it's quite impressive that this amount of money has gone out the door this quickly in a brand new program.
So, I mean, presumably one reason to put more money in this program is that if you don't, it will basically have been arbitrary which businesses got this money and which didn't. It's sort of whoever got their applications in fastest. What's your skepticism about this program? Is your concern that it's not necessarily well targeted to actually get in the hands of workers?
First of all, I agree that once you have it, you should fully fund it. And it's actually worse than arbitrary because a lot of the ones that got it would be the more financially sophisticated and larger. And the ones that are further behind in the line are some of the smaller, less advantaged businesses. So absolutely fully fund it. You know, in terms of what I'm concerned with, I don't know how many businesses are going to have a different level of employment in December 2020 as a result of this program. Maybe it'll have a temporary impact. I think in many cases, it'll be a windfall for the owners of businesses. The criteria for how severely affected you were was basically non-existent. And, you know, if you were heavily impacted, you know, even with this money, it's not enough to keep going. So, you know, I don't know how much of a difference it's going to make after the program expires, but, you know, we have it, so we should fund it.
Christina, I feel like there's been a little bit of a contradiction in the way that people on the left have talked about this economic response, because one thing I hear is, you know, you should bail out people, you shouldn't bail out corporations. I've also heard a lot of enthusiasm for programs that are being done in some other countries like the United Kingdom and Denmark, where the government basically starts paying the majority of the wage bill of private companies. 75% or 80% of the wages just get paid by the government. And as Jason notes, you know, in some cases that will keep people in jobs who otherwise would have been laid off. But in other cases, you have a business that's still operating that would have kept its employees on the payroll in any case. As he notes, you know, you probably qualify for this PPP program even if you weren't that severely impacted. And that ends up just accruing to the owner of the business. So what is the right approach if you're trying to get money in the hands of workers? Do we want something like this PPP program to be even bigger, or was that a mistake?
So I think you've got some good points there. I think one of the differences that we're seeing in how the PPP program, at least this first tranche, has been instituted is that, yeah, there is not particularly good regulation on what sort of small businesses get the money from this program. So yes, there are many, you can't see my quote unquote hands here, but small businesses that would have survived anyway that are now just sort of feeding at the trough, taking this money. They weren't going to lay anyone off. But actual small businesses, you know, especially those that are women-owned, minority-owned, those that don't have pre-existing relationships with commercial banks, large lenders, or in fact, government aides who can help them navigate the system, are the ones that ended up last in line and aren't getting any of this at all. So their business is still struggling, and those workers are not going to get payroll.
Rich, the flip side of that, I mean, as Christine notes, that the program is not especially targeted, but if you tried to target it more, the program would have been slower at getting money out the door. Banks already had quite a bit of difficulty processing these loans. Just because all the money has been allocated doesn't mean that it's all in the hands of business owners already. In fact, the Washington Post suggests that most of this money has not yet been dispersed. So it's like the trade-off that we see in a lot of these cases where, you know, if you want to be more careful about how you spend the money, you may not get it out fast enough to do what you need to do in the economy. And so I guess the question is, you know, this program is sort of Marco Rubio's baby. In partial retrospect, as we're a few weeks into this, was this the right approach to try to get the money out?
Well, it's understandable that the imperative at the time was just get as much money out as possible and don't worry too much about the guidelines or various strictures. But I think in retrospect, there are some key design flaws. I mean, this isn't really a very helpful way to go about it for businesses for which payroll is not a big portion of overall expenses. You know, there are businesses whose employees might actually be better off on unemployment than staying employed by the company. So I'm a little more inclined towards the Josh Hawley proposal now, which would directly aid businesses and more directly attempt to pay their payroll.
Jason, how do you think the act is working overall? I mean, one thing about the approach in the law is that it had two different ways to deal with workers whose labor has been severely impacted by this crisis. You have the PPP, which was intended to give grants to their employers to keep them on the payroll. You also have some lending to larger businesses that is intended to do that. But then you also have these very enhanced unemployment benefits. So the idea is we try to keep you on your employer's payroll, and if you don't stay on that payroll, we give you a much more generous unemployment benefit that replaces typically at least all of your income up to an annualized salary of $50,000. Is that proving to be adequate?
The state systems are proving to be inadequate, but once you get through the state systems, yes, the unemployment insurance provision is a great provision for workers, and it's a great provision for businesses. If you don't have any business right now, you can furlough your employees. Your employees will get paid roughly what they were paid before. Is a big issue with health insurance. I think that's a big omission, but set that to the side for a moment. And the business saves on those labor costs. If you're able to restart your business, then you're going to go back and hire those very same employees. So unemployment statistics right now are very misleading. They don't tell you about permanent changes in job matches. But then the final advantage of unemployment insurance is that if your business can't restart, it's consistent with some reallocation across the economy. And I think the problem we have for a lot of policy right now is partly we have a temporary interruption in the economy, but partly we have a massive, massive sectoral change in the economy. And we need to be able to make those sectoral changes, shifting people, you know, away from working in movie theaters and into working on delivery and the like. And people-based plans can do a better job with the dynamic, flexible economy we're going to need.
Your position on that is different from what I hear from a lot of other policy commentators who have stressed the importance of maintaining the link between employees and employers, saying that keeping people on payroll makes it more likely that people will, in fact, go back to doing what they were doing before this crisis. And then otherwise, you have all these costs in the economy as businesses have to go out and figure out how to hire a new staff when they reopen instead of just hiring back their former workers. Why are you so confident that putting people on unemployment will just allow them to come back to where they were if that business is able to do what it was doing before the crisis?
Yeah, I think the economists that actually study the unemployment insurance system agree with me. I agree with you. There's an awful lot of commentators that don't study that system, that don't share that view. Macy's furloughed its employees. Macy's is paying their health insurance through the end of May. They are on the payroll of Macy's. They just are working 0 hours right now. If Macy's is able to reopen its stores, it's not going to set up a brand new business and set up a brand new hiring process. It has those people on payroll. Their hours are currently listed as zero. They'll change those hours, get them back to work, and start paying them. You're seeing that in an awful lot of businesses. That's the way the unemployment insurance system works. That's the way furloughs work. And just even a tiny bit of logic says, if you have a business, what are you going to do? Go back to the people that were working for you? Or not. There's something slightly collusive about unemployment insurance where a decent employer can say to a worker, you know what, I don't have any work for you right now. you're going to get paid by the government. You're not going to get paid by me. As soon as I have work, you know, would love to have you back.
Christine, Jason referenced the difficulty that a lot of states are having getting this money out the door, and that difficulty has been abating somewhat. According to the Associated Press, 32 states were going to be paying the enhanced unemployment by the end of this week. I know in New York, checks were going out this week. But a lot of people have been waiting for this money for several weeks, and while they will get it retroactively, you know, a lot of people are very crunched for cash right now for obvious reasons. I've been struck by how positive the polling is on the government response to this, especially governors who ultimately oversee these state unemployment insurance systems. Their approval ratings have generally soared. So it seems like for now, the public is patient with the idea that it's going to take some time. I'm just wondering how long that patience will persist when in some states like Florida, it seems like the problems with the unemployment capacity are really serious and it's taking them forever to process the claims.
Yeah, that's actually exactly the example that I was going to use, Florida, and how, you know, part of Rick Scott's platform basically was to make unemployment benefits as hard to access as humanly possible. I think what we're seeing in these delays is kind of the inevitable result of Republicans in particular just wrapping the safety net, all parts of the safety net, up in red tape so that when there is an actual emergency, you know, people are unable to access it. It's not just unemployment benefits. I mean, it's things like SNAP, you know, supplemental nutrition assistance, or in many cases, there's an asset limit. You're only allowed to have saved up to a certain amount. Otherwise, you're not eligible for food assistance. Well, what happens when there's a rainy day like this? We would have wanted people actually to have saved up a lot more money. But unfortunately, in order to be able to access benefits, the government would not have allowed that. You know, insidious ways of pushing people off of assistance, of making benefits harder to reach, whether through bureaucracy, whether through, you know, drowning government in a bathtub and just not funding them fully, have come from the right for decades, and we're now seeing the fallout. It's also interesting the way that these programs have taken form. There's still this real unwillingness, as you pointed out earlier, to reach out to individuals. You know, all sorts of assistance has to be filtered through business, through a payroll plan, through a small business administration. And yeah, that makes it harder for actual individuals who better understand their individual needs and their, say, future employment prospects to be flexible. And that's a problem right now when flexibility is in high demand.
Rich, what do you make of Christine's criticism there? Because, I mean, in Florida, you have all the Republicans trying to blame each other for who screwed up this UI system. They've been running the state for 20 years, so it's not like they can blame anybody else. But it seems broadly like Republican efforts to shrink aspects of the safety net to reduce their efficacy. We've gotten to this point now where we really need that safety net infrastructure in order to distribute large amounts of money. In a lot of places, that safety net infrastructure is breaking down. Wasn't that a mistake?
Yeah, I think this is more endemic than an evil Republican plot. I mean, you have states that have been run by Democrats for a very long time that have computer systems running their unemployment system that are, you know, 40, 50 years old and aren't taught by anyone anymore, just because government bureaucracy just inherently does not tend to be efficient or keep up to date. I mean, if there's anything established by social science, it's that.
Jason, what do you see going forward as what the government needs to do in order to keep this response robust enough to prop up the economy?
The most important thing here economically is going to be how long this lockdown lasts. There's no policy that can keep the economy together if the lockdown goes as long as it might need to. And it might need to because, you know, the health situation could be even worse than it. Conversely, if you know, some of these antivirals come through and alike, we're going to see a lot of things coming back together because the CARES Act did maintain demand. The Fed is maintaining the financial system and, you know, there will be something to restart. And so just, you know, the health side remains the most important part of the economic side of all of this.
We have to leave that there. Jason Furman from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and former chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Christine Embo, what's your rant?
So I want to rant against TV doctors. So not Dr. Tony Fauci, who is an actual doctor, cautious in his pronouncements and seemingly the lone voice of reason in the rogues gallery that President Trump assembles every evening. No, I'm talking about Dr. Oz, Dr. Phil, and all of those charlatans who are using a pandemic as a ploy for screen time and giving bad advice to Americans in the process. So earlier this week, Dr. Oz suggested that a 2-3% rise in mortality is a good trade-off for opening schools, in which case I wonder, who exactly are you volunteering for death? Dr. Oz, yourself? And then there's Dr. Phil, who compared coronavirus to automobile, swimming pool, and cigarette deaths, which A, are not contagious, and B, he got the numbers for most of those totally wrong. Look, if these guys actually wanted to help, to be real doctors, they'd read the Hippocratic Oath, strap on a mask, and go to a hospital. But they won't, because they're in it for the profits. And, oh yeah, Dr. Phil isn't even a real medical doctor. Physician, heal thyself. Or at least don't condemn me to death.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Despite our endless sources of information and platforms for debate, we live in an era of enforced conformity, or at least attempted enforced conformity, when Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton suggested weeks ago that the coronavirus might have escaped from a research lab in Wuhan. He was relentlessly mocked and fact-checked. Now it turns out the U.S. government is inclined to believe the same thing. It's bizarre for a conservative to have to say this, but dissenting opinions are a good thing. We can disagree with them, but we should never try simply to shut them down.
For my rant, as we discussed on the show, there has been somewhat uneven execution of the economic programs that are supposed to rescue us from the damage from the coronavirus epidemic. And people have valid complaints about these. But I've been seeing a lot of comparisons to foreign countries that take the actually executed version of our programs against an idealized version of their programs, or often even a fictional version. I've seen so many people on Twitter say that Canada is giving everybody $2,000 a month in Canada. That's not true. That's Canada's benefit for people who have lost work as a result of this crisis. You can compare that against our enhanced unemployment, which is a little more than $2,400 a month. And if you look at newspapers in these other countries, you see a lot of similar stories to the ones that you're seeing here about execution problems, businesses having difficulty getting loans from those countries' programs that are intended to support businesses. I'm not saying that everyone is screwing up in exactly the same ways. Some countries are doing better. Some countries are doing worse. Switzerland seems to be doing especially well issuing business loans, probably because the country has so many bankers. Some countries did have a more robust safety net going into this that has allowed them to move checks faster. But in general, there's this assumption, especially among people on the left, that basically other countries have these perfect governments that are so good at providing support to everyone. In fact, everyone is clawing their way through this unprecedented situation, trying to find ways to do new things that are big and difficult and having uneven results. And so you should just know that the U.S. is not alone in its imperfect response. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Christine Emba, Dan Dresner, and Jason Furman. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is Kat Yore. Special thanks to Brian Hardzinski and Rebecca Mooney. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.